Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming along this afternoon. I do appreciate your taking time out of your afternoon to hear what I guess will be a non-standard talk, but about someone that you're all familiar with. Here he is. This is, oh. Now,
what will be closing if we close the program?
Oh dear. We have the gremlins in, I think, this afternoon.
The worst day.
All right, okay. Here he is, Paul Dirac, positioning himself behind the king of physics, 1927, the famous Solvay meeting. This picture taken within a stone's throw of the European Parliament in Brussels, where you know that my Prime Minister, James Cameron, Mr. Cameron, I should say, has had such a diplomatic triumph over the last week or so. No reaction. In Britain, that would get a major reaction. Right. Now, you'll know this is famous because of this galaxy of physics stars here. But I think even when this picture was taken, it was known that this young gentleman here was special, something different about him. Not to say better, but different. For a start, you'll know that these people here, mainly gentlemen, unfortunately, but were engaged in a philosophical debate about the state of quantum mechanics, famous Bohr-Einstein debates. This person here, Paul Dirac, totally avoided them, had no interest in them, whatever. For him, quantum mechanics was about getting results. It was not about indulging one's fantasies about philosophical niceties. Einstein himself, shortly before this picture was taken, was reading the work of Dirac, which seemed extremely odd to people of Einstein and what you might call the German tradition in theoretical physics. He talked about Dirac walking a narrow path between genius and madness. Dirac's papers did look genuinely odd. People resented it in Germany, as we know from the memoirs of Dirac's brother-in-law, Eugene Wigner. In addition to the fact that people knew that he was an outstanding physicist, totally uninterested in philosophy, he was also a deeply strange man. And you'll know, as theoretical physicists, in order to get your PhD, you have to have at least one Dirac story. And I'm sure that's why many of you have come here, to make sure that you've got at least one new story. This gentleman here, Niels Bohr, actually had his own institute in Copenhagen, and he welcomed Dirac straight from Cambridge, where he got his PhD, the first PhD in quantum mechanics. And he found that Dirac was the first binary speaker he'd met. Whatever question you asked him, he would have two answers, yes or no. And if he was feeling exceptionally chatty, he might say, I don't mind. This was the extent of the Dirac interaction with the outside world. And this is why Bohr described him in later life, this is Dirac, as the strangest man I ever welcomed to my institute. And as you know, as theoretical physicists, that is saying something. Now, this afternoon, what I want to do, two things. First of all, I want to look at Dirac's approach to theoretical physics, which is unique. Again, I want to stress here, I'm not here as chief executive of Dirac's fan club. I'm not saying it's the best or the worst or anything. I'm saying this is a very, very unusual approach, which everyone acknowledges now. You often hear him called the theoretician's theoretician. You often hear him called that. Why? Well, you're looking at a very, very mathematical approach to the subject, no doubt about that. Very plain-spoken English in the way he writes. Very geometric in his approach to the subject, something that deeply surprised Robert Oppenheimer, who didn't even realize this. This was in 1962. But now we recognize him as a pioneer of a geometric approach to quantum mechanics, quantum field theory. And perhaps became clearer after this picture was taken, the most revolutionary spirit. This was not a casual revolutionary, right? This was someone who really did believe that theories were here today, gone tomorrow, and you toss them out when they're not ready, right? Or they don't fit the facts, so to speak. This was not someone, as I said, who was casual in this. He really did have that belief for the rest of his life and had beliefs that other physicists regard as completely crazy. You'll know about the, for example, of the infinite negative energy C, for example, things people would just thought were absolutely mad. This is something that Dirac would hold on to with and regard as not worthy of debating. The second thing I want to look at is his unique personality. Theoretical physics has not seen anyone quite like Dirac. You're talking about here someone with a rectilinear sense of logic, someone who never used one word where none would do, had virtually zero empathy, no interest in what you think, actually, no interest really at all, apart from what you might care to write down in a paper. And apparently only one, if you read most articles about him, only one interest, and that is theoretical physics and possibly mathematics. So where did he get this personality from? Well, if you believe him, it all started here. This is where he was born, on the 8th of August, 1902. This is in a modest, terraced set of houses in North Bristol, the largest town in largest city in the west of England. And he was, in all probability, born in that room up there. 3:30 in the morning, that's where his mother's bedroom was. That's why I say that. Now, this was the only picture of the Dirac family I've ever come across. And that's not for want of trying. It looks pretty much, this picture was taken in 1907, a few weeks before Dirac went to school. Looks pretty much an ordinary family. Pretty regular. Until you get into underneath this story and find you have a kind of child called it story, an ex-certificate childhood. In fact, Dirac actually said in later life, I never had a childhood. Well, let me just glimpse quickly about the kind of environment our Paul Dirac was brought up in. Father would only speak to his children in French. Mother would only speak to her children in English. He often said that he thought men spoke. Yes, you can complete the sentence. You're so smart, I don't even need to tell you the rest of the story, but it's true. This was his elder brother, Felix, his younger sister, Betty. His father forbade visitors. They never had visitors outside of very occasional visits from close family. It was a kind of balkanized household where he and his father would sit in the front room speaking only French, and in the kitchen, his mother and his two siblings were speaking English. That's bad enough. It gets worse. His father, who was the school disciplinarian, a local school teacher, would punish him for any mistake he made in French. Wrong gerund, wrong tense, you name it. Anything, he would be punished. Dirac had terrible problems with digestion as a young boy, so he would often want to be sick at the table. Like other people, he often wanted to go to the bathroom. His father would forbid him explicitly to do that. So he would have what we would call horrible accidents, wait for it, every day. Now, you probably don't believe that. I find it difficult to believe too. That testimony is written down in writing from his wife and was at least partially confirmed by him, by people I've actually met. His life around that table was totally horrendous. And this is why, if you believe Paul, he was driven into himself. So he said he knew how quiet he was. And he said he found it easier to say nothing rather than to risk some kind of error with his domineering father. Now, one thing Paul Dirac always agreed with was that he had an absolutely first-rate education. Just around the corner, he was at school, at Bishop's Road, just around the corner, and he was a very, very quiet boy. One of the pupils he didn't speak to was Cary Grant. Cary Grant was in the year below him. And they both, big boys, would learn technical drawing at school. Since the 1851 exhibition in London, the whole curriculum of schools like this had been taken over, and he'd been given a very prescribed curriculum. Aspects of this curriculum, one, an appreciation of beauty, very important. Constant school trips out to cultivate an appreciation of beauty in local museums, and very important for the boys, not the girls, they were doing sewing, the boys did technical drawing. So from the age of five, Dirac had a geometric approach to the world imposed on him alongside his classes in geometry and what have you. And he studied this subject of technical drawing for 9 years on non-stop. So he became really highly clued up in this geometric depiction of artificial stuff, which is, it's not a particularly good contrast here, but you can see what this is, those of you who have ever studied technical drawing. He actually wasn't that brilliant a child. He was very clever, but he wasn't someone you'd say, wow, this is someone absolutely out of this world. So he made good progress at junior school, but it was when he moved on to his father's school, the Merchant Venturers, just round the corner from when Cary Grant became a trapeze artist, right, in Bristol. He went to this school where his father was the head of modern languages. Now, this is where Dirac took off. This is very important to pick up what kind of school this is. It was funded by a bunch of philanthropists who used to make their money from the slave trade. And what they did was they had a school here that was relentlessly practical. No dead languages, only Charles Dirac only taught French, German, and other 8 or 9 languages he learned allegedly over the summer. And Paul and his brother studied these practical subjects in this school. And the dates at which he was at that school are absolutely critical. 1914 to 1918, the First World War, when people down as young as 1 year older than Dirac, we could have lost him, were off to the killing fields in Europe, while he, being very bright, was advancing very fast. And my God, was he advancing fast. His maths teacher, we have a testimony from, found him so difficult to challenge that he gave him books on Riemannian geometry. This is 1915. We don't know anything about general relativity. He was being given books on Riemannian geometry to keep him challenged. I say again, reminder, he's doing advanced technical drawing classes and showing that he's a first-rate, by child standards, a very, very bright mathematical student. Now, at this stage, the boys look like this. My grandmother will have seen these two boys walk around Bristol. People used to stop them in the streets. She was brought up there. But it was well known that there were these two boys, you could stop them, and you could ask them any question in French, and they would give you a perfect answer. The brothers Dirac. And they were very close at that time. Paul didn't know what to do when he went to university, so he followed Felix, much less bright, and became an engineer. Now, this is a really important thing to understand. The great George Orwell, one of my favorite observations about English life in the early 20th century, said that all boys in the first 20 years of the 20th century can be regarded intellectually as the sons of H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was the most popular writer at that time, determined to bring into public life the idea that Britain needed good engineers and good scientists to inform government. So it was perfectly natural that Charles Dirac would deny this boy here his dear wish to be a doctor and force him to do engineering. Our Dirac here followed him into that subject. And here he is, as an engineering student out on a half-day outing to watch motor cars being assembled. Here he is. In March 11th, 1919, what's Dirac learning when you guys almost certainly were doing advanced mathematics, very fancy Maxwell's equations and what have you? He is learning how to build airplanes, looking at the most modern car designs, learning how to fill in tax forms, right? He is doing what we would now call, you know, high technology, but of an old-fashioned engineering type. And he was bored, really bored. One of the reasons why was that, like many of you, perhaps certainly like me, terrible with his hands. The only thing he ever failed, right, was a placement in a factory in rugby. Right? Absolutely disastrous. He was born with bananas on the end of his fingers. Absolutely hopeless. A few months after this was taken, something signally important happened to him. This guy found out with his colleagues that there was this mysterious German, remember, deep enemy, deep enemy who just, in their view, just precipitated this awful war that they'd seen so many of their friends and family killed in, had made this discovery. You all know what that was, right? It was the testing of Einstein's general theory of relativity. And thanks to a brilliant piece of PR work, which that's what it was, Einstein was artificially made a star by George Dyson and Sir Arthur Eddington. an act of wanton publicity that Simon Cowell would be perfectly proud of, right? They arranged a black and white comparison between Einstein's predictions and the results of the ecliptic bending experiment in that year. And of course, Einstein won. All over the newspapers, all over the world, Einstein became almost literally overnight, a world star, from being a stellar theoretical physicist nobody had heard of to a world figure. And this guy here read about it and was absolutely fascinated by it. And he took up, like many of his school friends, he went to a course in relativity and learnt special and general relativity at the same time from, wait for it, a philosopher. Charlie Broad, who had done a degree in natural science at Cambridge, right? Someone who actually had a slight disdain for his own subject of philosophy, but he was very proud right up to his death in 1970 that he was the person who taught Dirac relativity, special and general at the same time. Not to the extent that you would learn it, but to the extent of having an appreciation of what those theories meant. And poor Dirac was reduced to sitting in that library, looking at the Nature articles, trying to find a picture of Einstein. There was hardly any of them around, right? Coming to grips with this thing and falling in love with the idea of theoretical physics. Remember, he was an engineer. Now, he graduated in 1921, and we now know was the most successful engineering graduate Britain produced in the entire 20th century. He was rewarded by a certificate of unemployment. It was the worst downturn in the economy until this one, the one we have now. Paul Dirac was reduced, this fate worse than death for theoreticians, to doing experiments in the Bristol laboratory with a stroboscope, and had absolutely no clue about what he was doing. And one of his teachers, David Robertson, we're greatly indebted to him, saw him fiddling around in the practical lab and said, what we need you to do, young Paul, I'm making this up, but it's close enough, is do a maths degree. So he yanked this guy and got him to hitch a ride on the Bristol University maths degree, which he would do in 2 years, not three. So he went into that class and they said, who is this guy? Sits at the front, never talks, right? And he immediately went to the top of the class. Now, that's not particularly interesting. What is interesting is what he was doing when he was studying mathematics. First of all, thousands of examples. Don't ever resent, I'm sure you don't, because that's why you're successful, that's why you're sitting here, doing thousands of examples, one after the other, of applied mathematics. Much more important than that, perhaps that's an overstatement, more important than that hard driving work, becoming an expert applied mathematician, was that he had the best teacher he ever had in his life, and that's quoting him. His name, unless you've read my book, you've almost certainly never heard of. His name is Peter Fraser. Peter Fraser never wrote a research paper in his life, but he was, as Dirac said, a stupendously good teacher. What was he interested in? Well, the love of his life was projective geometry. Now, those of you who know your French history or even your deep mathematical physics will know that technical drawing and projective geometry are so close, they were virtually invented by the same person, Monge in France. French school children are taught this in the same classes in some cases. So he was getting the mathematics, projective geometry, of what he had seen as a child in his technical drawing classes. And he loved this subject. He absolutely loved it. The way you could get theorems about lines and planes, one from the other, for its great mathematical beauty and elegance. And Peter Fraser nurtured Dirac's talent, and this is from Dirac's reports, not anywhere else, his realization that mathematics could be a beautiful subject by its elegance, its completeness, its universality, all the things that you know about. Now, at the same time that he was doing this, there's one person who, if you believe Dirac's testimony, he absolutely detested, who was making representations for him, and that person was his father. His father was writing to Cambridge saying that his son was a boy of exceptional mathematical talent. And although the family, according to his father, had no money, could they please take him on? And they rejected him for a year. And then the second year, he took an exam, and I didn't actually meet him, but I know someone who did, who marked his papers. And they were extraordinary. He didn't get everything right, but what he did do, there was a sign of a really first-rate mind, not in the best maths department in the country in Bristol, but someone who really, really was obviously very, very smart. So Cambridge, in a brilliant move, brilliant, brilliant move, they took him in, basically, virtually for nothing. So he arrived in St. John's College, Cambridge, on the 1st of October, 1923. Now, this is where we first see what an odd character we have on our plate, ladies and gentlemen. He was studying with the best supervisor that Cambridge had at that time, Ralph Fowler, Henry VIII type figure, burly, bone-crushing handshake, right? Not world, super world class, but very, very good, international standard in statistical mechanics and in quantum theory. Right, a tremendously good supervisor. And he had this very quiet young chap, Al Dirac, come to see him, very disappointed, because what Dirac wanted to study was relativity. But instead, Dirac had to study quantum theory. And in what he used to do on Saturday afternoons was go to mathematics tea parties to study projective geometry again. Right? And at the same time, his hobby was taking classical theories and tweaking them into relativistic versions of each other. That's what Dirac was doing. Other people were out having parties, going to Greek plays and what have you. That's what Dirac was doing, tweaking things, taking classical Newtonian Lagrange-type formulations into ones that were consistent with the special theory of relativity. Now, I can't be sure about this, but I'm very, very confident that Dirac would have been seen as deeply uncouth, deeply below the salt. Right? We actually know that in one of those words, the uncouth, from a reference he was given in Bristol. Why? Well, he had no money. He hadn't got Latin or Greek, so he wasn't allowed to do an undergraduate degree. Right? He had no fine manners. Remember, he was not from a fancy home like many of those people there. He did not know what Maxwell's equations were when he arrived. Everybody else did. A few years later, he quantized them, but let's leave that to one side. He did not know what they were. He also had the most extraordinary background, right? He came, remember, fully fledged as an engineering graduate, as a very clued up young mathematician studying physics. That was unique. But it gave him a very unusual perspective on these problems that, like any good supervisor, Ralph Fowler gave to him. And he soon established himself, that's Dirac, as a very, very bright graduate student, churning out, I shouldn't say that's disrespectful, but producing very good papers, not world-shaking, but very good papers. And as one of his references said, which I dug up, he has the most potential research student we've seen for some years in this department, which is saying something in Cambridge. But I'm not pretending to you that he was being seen as seen as the next Einstein of that time. That's just completely untrue. That he was good was without problem. He was sailing towards a rock-solid, certain PhD that everyone would have forgotten. Everything changed in his emotional life, insofar as he had one. Remember, most people would have seen him as a walking straight line because he had no visible personality. In March 1925, he heard that his brother had killed himself. Dirac hadn't spoken to his brother for 3 years. They'd fallen out so badly they'd walk on opposite sides of the street to avoid seeing each other. Even now I get goosebumps, as you can see in the front row here, thinking about this. So there's his brother, whom he hadn't spoken to for years, beyond maybe hello when they got home to see their parents, but basically had not spoken to, had killed himself, checking out of his digs where he was earning a living as a draftsman. Remember, he wanted to be a doctor, being forced out of it by his doctor. When he ran out of money, he cycled off to the Shropshire countryside and drank some potassium cyanide. Dirac never said a word about this, right? It's the one subject that was off limits to his family. I can still remember both of his daughters telling me that one afternoon he showed them a picture of his brother Felix, right, in a tobacco tin and put it back, and he still couldn't bring himself to mention his name. He was 55 years old then. So goodness knows what effect this had. One thing we know is it stopped him producing papers. So he was human. It's quite clear that something happened that stopped him producing. He produced 5 or 6 papers. Then, right out of the blue, he went home to his grieving family in North Bristol, and this paper was sent to him by his wonderfully generous supervisor, Ralph Fowler. This was a paper by a fellow you may have heard of called Heisenberg. Now, Heisenberg had given a talk at Cambridge a few weeks before. Dirac couldn't even remember whether he went to it. Often he slept through seminars. I see none of you are doing that. I'm very grateful for that. And he sent what we now know, let's not beat about the bush, this was the first paper of quantum mechanics. But let's also be very clear, Dirac did not know that. This was a new approach to a subject that Dirac had found increasingly unsatisfactory, the Bohr model of the atom, the Bohr approach to quantization and quantum theory. Here was a completely new approach using what we now call matrix mechanics. Dirac, according to later report, said, there's no way the world could be this complicated. Put it aside. 2 weeks later, roughly, his report, he goes back and sees something in brackets on page 6. In our language, let's keep it quick, that Heisenberg said, well, position and momentum don't actually commute, but that's a detail, we'll sort that out. Right? It was an embarrassment. Another quote from Heisenberg. It was an embarrassment theory that would be sorted out. Dirac had seen that kind of what we would now call non-commutation in the theory of projective geometry. It hit him. This was the secret. He took that outstanding thread from Heisenberg, right, and he wove that into his view of quantum mechanics. And a few months later, we had the first great paper from Dirac, The Fundamental Equations of Quantum Mechanics. And that was informed by his great epiphany, the one that he regarded as the most important thing he did in his life. That was him cut when he was 80 years old, the Poisson bracket, which he got from a study of classical mechanics. And he saw, notice it was a visual thing, that he saw this kind of construction that you see in a Poisson bracket in the equations of quantum mechanics, and then he then generalized it to produce this version of quantum mechanics that was not like Heisenberg's. Heisenberg saw it as a clean break from classical mechanics. Dirac's vision of quantum mechanics was one where you could proceed largely by analogy with the Poisson bracket and the other formulations like that that he'd learnt from Rafe Fowler. Now, Freeman Dyson, my friend at the Institute for Advanced Study, still my favorite image of Dirac. What made Dirac special among the early quantum pioneers? Well, I can still see Freeman saying this to me now, that Dirac's papers arrived like perfectly carved marble statues dropping from heaven. Good phrase, not mine, it's Freeman's. If you go back, you can still read them. You can still read those papers today. There's absolutely no denying the brilliance of Heisenberg. Dirac would always say quantum mechanics was his invention. Nor can you deny the complementary invention by Schrödinger of wave mechanics. But Dirac's looks so modern to this day, and his papers, unlike all of them, except that wonderful set that Schrödinger did, which was a beautiful set of papers where he got his, we applied his stuff to the hydrogen atom. Dirac's have that inevitability that we treasure to this day. Let's just go through very, very quickly and just see the way this chicken was laying golden eggs. First of all, his PhD, the world's first PhD in quantum mechanics. Letter from his examiners saying this was the finest PhD they'd read in living memory. He stays on over the summer, probably to avoid going home to his parents. In a sultry July week, he invents what we now call Fermi-Dirac statistics. He goes to Copenhagen at the adjuration of Fowler, saying, get out of this place, just get out and go somewhere and meet some people. He goes to Copenhagen, meets Born. In the first 6 weeks, he produces transformation theory in quantum mechanics, which relates Schrödinger's and Heisenberg's approaches and enables you to go back and forth. Aside, he introduces the Dirac delta function. Where did he get, incidentally, he was not the first person to produce that function, right? Right, he may not have known, I'm pretty sure he didn't, right? But he was the person who really brought it in as a mathematical tool, and it was perfectly natural that he developed that from the work of Heaviside as an engineer who'd introduced the subject of operational calculus. You can see very easily how those things come in. I'm not trying to diminish Dirac's achievement here, I'm simply saying it came out of his engineering training, that if you have a beam here, that if you have a load spread like so, why can't there be a limit where you have a point limit? And that's how he used to describe that to popular audiences. But before he left Copenhagen, he produces quantum field theory. He produces one of the two papers on quantum field theory and then frees himself up to derive the black body radiation spectrum. And then he goes off to Göttingen, and here is him in the back garden of Max Born. This, I think, you could reasonably call the birth area of quantum mechanics. I know you can argue about these things, but Max Born definitely saw himself as the father of this area, deeply resented the way other people overlooked his view. One American chap said he passed Born's office and saw him with his jaws wide open while Dirac was talking, which is difficult to believe, but he said, where did this guy come from? They'd thought of Dirac as an unknown mathematician they'd never heard of. But he was basically giving these people the runaround. And there's his great friend and admirer, Oppenheimer, right behind. See Oppenheimer there? And this is the guy who couldn't give a damn, basically. He's working. He was the workaholic's workaholic. Now, I have a theory about what he's reading here. It's probably wrong, but it will do anyway. It was at this time that he started to apply that field theory to look at the scattering of the electron, the photon from the electron. And he found there, you can go back and look at his paper, that when he looked, applied that field theory, he would get infinity when he started to look at the energy of the system. This, rather like Heisenberg, he said, this can't be right. This can't be right. We'll sort that out. Ladies and gentlemen, he never sorted that problem out. As you will hear, he never believed that, he never, to his dying breath, believed that human beings had a rigorous way of calculating the simple energy of an electron and a photon. And it began here in Göttingen, that thing that was if you like, a tragedy that blighted his appreciation of physics. But it's important to remember that. I'm not overstating it. This is where he discovered it. Very brief interlude. Dirac had no political interests, we're told. Nonsense. He was fascinated by the Soviet Union and by the application of communism in Stalin's Russia. Here he is. One of 8 trips he made to the Soviet Union. And he was introduced to that by the person who became, in my view, his surrogate brother, Peter Kapitsa. And later by another great Russian theoretician, Igor Tam, whom he loved dearly as he loved Patrick Blackett, who was the most politically active of people in Rutherford's laboratory. We're told that Dirac had absolutely no interest in practical physics. Rubbish. He was spending day after day, especially as he got more and more disillusioned with quantum field theory, he was doing experiments with Kapitsa and Blackett in that laboratory with his overalls on and all the rest of it. Not doing quantum field theory, but he was the first person to produce a method of separating nuclear isotopes in apparatus with no moving parts. So it's completely wrong to say that he was not interested in actually doing experiments. He did them with his best friend in Rutherford's laboratory. But he was fascinated by Russia, and particularly applauded, of course, its godless and anti attitude to religion. They knew there shouldn't be one. He used to say that his religion was that humankind must improve. Back to physics. This was the high point. And this is where we all, those of you in the game, right, know, right, no matter that physics is essential, like all science, is a collaborative process. But what you dream of, what you really want, is to have a time when you, preferably just you, possibly you and one collaborator, know something that nobody else knows, even if it's just once. That everyone knows that you knew that first. And that's what Dirac had when he started to apply relativity to the Schrodinger equation. Remember, Schrodinger equation, of course, is not relativistically invariant, and he tweaked that like he was when he was a beginning graduate student. And he produced what you now are very familiar with, the Dirac equation, which is the only equation in Westminster Abbey. Here it is. Here. Now, this was seen as a miracle at the time. There was many, many people you could see at the time. Even Heisenberg told one of his students, there was this English theoretician, if he works on a subject, there's no point in working on it. He's just so incredibly smart. There was something I counted at one point, I think 14 people of Nobel level who were trying to solve that problem at the same time. But it was Dirac who came out with this beautiful equation that resembled nothing anyone else had ever seen before. And of course, as you'll know, explained not only did it bring together quantum theory and special relativity, but it explained spin naturally and the magnetic moment of the electron. It was just the thing we all dream of doing, and he happens to very few of us. He had seen Einstein lay the golden egg of the general relativity equations. Dirac had done it with this equation here. The problem is, of course, as you know, is that this equation at the time was seen as deeply, deeply diseased because of the negative energy states that it had. I'm going to cast a veil over that because it would take me much too long to go into the details. But this was not. Although you could say it was his most famous paper, he was still moving and still producing great stuff. Remember his book, 1930, The Principles of Quantum Mechanics. Even people who didn't like him, well, weren't that many because they didn't have much view of him, but saw this as a straight-out masterpiece. Max Born, Wolfgang Pauli, first-rate physicists were producing what looked quite muddled books. Dirac's book is like an extended prose poem, still in print to this day. And this picture was taken in Princeton when he was there with a double act with the person he most disliked on the front line of physics, Wolfgang Pauli. And this is where he was talking about his famous work on the magnetic monopole, which he produced in a paper in 1931, which for me is his Hamlet. And by that, I mean, by Hamlet, I mean, actually, it's a bit of a heap, actually, this paper, but it is a total masterpiece, even though it's a heap. What do I mean by a heap? Well, first of all, he produces this fantastic paper, which Edward Wittenthal is still his favorite, on that produces the first quantum theory of the monopole that makes it look as though nature's surely got to choose this thing. He opens up with the most sublime confidence by saying that it was time to rethink the way we do theoretical physics. We shouldn't be looking over our shoulders at what experimenters say to us. Rather, we should take the cue from what Heisenberg did, what Einstein did, and look to mathematics. Look for mathematical structures that generalize ones that already work and see if we can then map them onto physics. He was deeply, deeply fascinated by the fact that quantum mechanics arrived with no interpretation. People were throwing at what this theory meant, even though it had great promise. And he thought that by looking into advanced mathematics, you might be able to map that onto physics. Now, this sounds a very strange thing to look at, but this was Dirac's philosophy articulated on the first page of that paper. As an aside, it had virtually nothing to do with the monopole, but he then throws in his solution to the negative energy problem and gives the theory that you all know about why there should be an anti-electron, where you have the negative energy levels are full, and by filling the occasional gaps in them, you should observe something called the anti-electron. And then next paragraph, the anti-proton. It's quite extraordinary the way you could see him riffing away like a jazz musician here. Quite extraordinary. Very important to remember that when that anti-electron was written about, first of all, he was very tentative about it. The only time I've ever seen him write and give what a reasonable person would say was a prediction was at Princeton where this picture was taken. He, other than that, a historian would say he was hedging his bets because it just wasn't done to predict new particles. It just wasn't done in those days. Now, when they found the thing, he was propelled to Stockholm. It was that they were having a lot of trouble giving the quantum mechanics Nobel Prize, contrary to what you might think when you read some physics books these days, because there wasn't enough to show that it was a real theory that was absolutely, definitely better than what preceded it. But in 1933, thanks to the discovery of the anti-electron, the positron, Dirac was given a share of the 1933 prize and became the youngest theoretician to win the prize, and he shared it with Schrödinger. He was then pretty well on top of the world. Youngest Nobelist I told you about. He had the Lucasian chair in physics, a fellow at St. John's College. There was also a slight problem that he was deeply disenchanted with the theory that he was most very, very famous for, namely quantum field theory. And what he was doing, following that paper I told you about, he was doing something that looked very, very strange. And if you look up on the history of the papers, you'll see very, very few people follow this. He was actually experimenting with mathematics, particularly at the IAS in Princeton, and just seeing if there was new branches of mathematics that might somehow have physical potential. It looked very, very odd indeed. And nobody, as far as I can see, followed that up. It would be read respectfully, but people thought this was the mathematician in Dirac flowering, but of no great physical significance. So, after that, Dirac moved away from quantum field theory, but also he was missing one thing. As a straight man, he was missing one thing, a woman. And he found one, or she found him, rather, in a what we would now call a bistro in Princeton in 1934. Dirac walked in, no doubt very sheepishly, saying nothing, and there was Eugene Wigner with his sister, Mansi Balash. And I don't know what she saw in him. He was probably the hottest physicist in the world at that time. Einstein wanted him more than anybody else to work at Princeton. Right? He was earning about $350,000 Canadian dollars a year. Not the most entertaining person on the block, perhaps. She was recently divorced from a playboy who'd been multiply unfaithful to her, and she was hanging out in Princeton, and she chased him quite clearly from her pursuit of sending him 8-page letters, only to get a reply of about 4 or 5 lines normally from him. In 1937, after Charles Dirac, the hated Charles Dirac, died, Dirac made sure they never met, notice, he proposed to Mansi, and her campaign was over. And this is them on Brighton Beach in January, freezing cold day in 1937, and Dirac, the engineer, is out here taking pictures remotely so that he didn't need a photographer to be with them. I should say that Dirac's wife, not what you might expect, never stopped talking, had opinions on everything and everyone, made friends very easily, very warm, very judgmental, no interest in science at all. So you could say that Dirac married his antiparticle. somehow that marriage survived. But how it survived was a mystery, not just to me, but his daughters, who told me that this following story is true, although it beggars belief, that one day, I think Dirac hadn't spoken a word for about a month. He was getting on fine with everyone, he just saw there was no need to speak. And his wife was absolutely sick of this, you see. So at the dinner table, she banged the table and said, "What would you say if I left you?" 30-second pause, Dirac turns to her and says, "I'd say goodbye, dear." Now, Dirac was now a family man. This was at the turn of the war. Very important to realize now that he's sick of quantum field theory. He's in a war. He's working on the nuclear bomb. Calculations on neutron diffusion, his system of isotope separation, and this is him reading The Wizard of Oz to his daughter Mary in 1940. For our purposes, though, this was taken around a very important time for him because he wrote his first philosophical paper at the invitation of Max Born, now ensconced in Edinburgh, the only refugee physicist given a permanent job at that time. He was the first person to get a job. And he invited Dirac to go up and talk about philosophy. And he wrote a paper that, ladies and gentlemen, I would go home tonight and read. It is an absolutely, wonderful paper called The Relation Between Mathematics and Physics. Now, when I first heard about this paper, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be terrifying, right? How many abstract mathematical variables would you expect with a title like that, right? The answer is none. Anyone can read this paper. It is absolutely staggering, right, in its insight, in its plain speaking, and in its, it's a wondrous paper. It's at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton where Lattie Seiberg first told me that this paper is one of Dirac's most remarkable achievements. The one thing I wanted to say to you now is that he announces here something he calls the principle of mathematical beauty. He decided, he postulates rather, that it was that physics advances by successively more beautiful theories as perceived mathematically. He doesn't actually define what that beauty is, but he says if you're a mathematician, you understand it immediately. Now, don't ask me to defend that logic. You can go and read it yourself. It's online. But that's what he says. He's now officially signed up to this idea that beauty is an extremely important criterion, and by the same token, he deplored the ugliness of approaches to patch up this infinity-plagued quantum field theory. Now, jumping ahead now to, this is Dirac in 1955, after Feynman, Schwinger, Tominaga, Dyson cleaned up quantum field theory, and Dirac wanted nothing to do with it. When Dyson told me that he was very proudly in Princeton, went up to Dirac for a metaphorical pat on the head and said, well, what do you think about the new quantum electrodynamics? And Dirac turned to him and he said, I would like it if it were not so ugly. And Dyson said he felt himself shrink like this. I should say that even after the whole panoply of Pucker renormalization theory has been brought in by Callan, Zamancic, and all these people, Dirac never believed it. He really did believe it was sweeping infinities under the carpet, and he never trusted that theory. It's of interest to say why. Why didn't he believe it? I would have thought that as an engineer, he would say, it works, what's the problem? Dirac wrote a paper on this much later in life than this, and he said it was because he was an engineer. He said, if you have an expansion as an engineer and you have an infinity in that process, you've got the wrong theory. It's as simple as that. And you can, if you don't believe me, that's what he says. He believes, I still don't understand that. I still don't know why engineering doesn't mean pragmatism, but that's what Dirac took it to mean. Now, the conventional story is Dirac did nothing now. Like his friend, not close friend, but friend Einstein, he might just as well have gone fishing. Completely untrue. It is true that that he was not doing revolutionary physics of the kind that he did in the golden period between 1925 and 1933. That's definitely true. But it is also true that after the war, he wrote in a paper very clearly that there's no reason in the equations of quantum mechanics that parity should not be conserved. He asked the question in a viva. He told colleagues this. He didn't run with it. Within weeks of this being taken here, his latest attempt to deconstruct quantum field theory, relativistic quantum field theory, and he was trying everything to see what he could take out of that theory to make it rigorous, in other words, devoid of these awful infinities. It was at Princeton that he finally said that he's decided the electron has to be an extended particle, which he called a string. I believe that's the first time that term, it's not the modern usage, of course, came into the language, was within weeks of this picture being taken. It was taken in Ottawa, incidentally, on a trip, he almost died, right? We know that because his wife wrote to his great friend Oppenheimer that she thought that he was basically in his last days. Answer was after a trip to India, and Oppenheimer went on a private visit. You can see the reports of it in Canadian newspapers. But it was interesting that Oppenheimer is so totally different to Dirac, who'd done a project that Dirac abominated, but it was Dirac who wanted to see him on what he thought was going to be his deathbed. Now, 1971, he had to give up the Lucasian chair in physics, and he moved to the 85th ranked physics department in America, Florida State University, who very cleverly got him over there. They didn't know, why should you have an old clapped out English physicist like this? Some of the more skeptical people said, and one of his colleagues said, this is a bit like having Shakespeare in the English faculty, which I thought was a good line. And they did invest in giving him a kind of what I gather in North America they call a moosehead professorship. In other words, all he has to do is be there, basically, and be Dirac. And that's where he spent the rest of his life, in this Keene building on Florida State campus. And what he was here, frankly, he was doing research. Needless to say, it wasn't groundbreaking particularly. What he spent most of his time doing was giving talks as the St. Paul, the apostle of mathematical beauty. I counted 632 talks. Virtually every one, the notes of them, mentioned mathematical beauty and how much he execrated the modern theory of quantum electrodynamics. When the November Revolution happened in 1977, I think 20 days after I began graduate work, he had no interest in the subject at all, which is borderline unforgivable, really. He was more interested in the Turing Shroud. He really had lost interest in modern physics. He'd also become, frankly, a philosopher. Like so many physicists are condemned to do this, as the detail becomes too much, they ascend into a kind of philosophical stratosphere. That's what he was doing. And a quieter life in this house, about 20 minutes walk from his office. Just a couple of things. He did mellow. His daughter said he did mellow. Yes, very, very quiet. But this myth that we've been reading about for years, no interest at all, completely untrue. His favorite singer was Cher. He once bought a color television so that he could watch her spectacle on his own one, Nancy, his wife, watched the Oscars. He would go and see every new James Bond film. He's literally, it's always completely unfathomable where his artistic taste come from. He would always go and see a new Bond film, every new Disney film he would go and see. He loved John le Carré, H.G. Wells, and would spend years reading the novels of Tolstoy. One thing, he was very well treated here, it must be said respectfully. His wife hated Cambridge, which he thought was snobbish, anti-spouse, or certainly anti-women. But these people really did give Dirac a very pleasant retirement. But the one thing he resented was he was always being introduced to people he didn't want to meet because he was Dirac. And I my favorite of those meetings, because I'd like Tom Stoppard to write a play about it, was one person he met by the name of Marlon Brando. The meeting was not a success, I should say. But I would love to have someone to make up what the conversation was like. So, and the person I met has got a picture of that meeting, incidentally. For someone who was so vehemently anti-religion, remember Paoli said there is no God and Dirac is his prophet? Well, he did mellow a bit, as we'll see at this meeting here at the Vatican. Really, Dirac's religion was mathematical beauty. He actually said on the record that mathematical beauty for him was like a religion. In fact, the exact quote is almost a religion for him and Schrödinger. If a theory wasn't mathematically beautiful and it aspired to be a fundamental theory of nature, he would rule it out, which he once did in a letter to Heisenberg that left Heisenberg completely nonplussed. He was also, as I said this before, worth stressing again, a complete revolutionary. He wasn't the kind of person who said, oh, do it like we did it. Do the stuff that the approach we use. He was completely opposite to that. And the person that found that out was Edward Witten in 1981. This picture supplied by Edward's wife, to whom I'm very grateful. And what was Dirac saying to Witten? Right? Just ignore quantum electrodynamics. It is wrong. Just do something else. Right? In other words, don't follow me. Not do something else in physics, but don't follow that theory. It was absolutely not the normal advice of either. In my day, we would have done it like this. He regarded his route into physics as being basically discredited. Well, I cannot resist reading this wonderful letter, right? Because Dirac, not letter, but extract from a letter. Dirac was feeling very low at this time. I've been very jocular in the way I presented this, but he thought physics had just taken a complete wrong turn. He thought that he told Pierre Ramond that his life's work had been wasted. He felt intimidated by these very brilliant young physicists, the Wilczeks, the Tahufs, and all these Weinbergs and what have you, right? He felt very intimidated by their company. He knew that they thought he was a fuddy-duddy. He knew that. And one person wrote to him within weeks of this picture being taken. And that person was the much-missed John Wheeler. When he got back from his last trip to Europe, right, Dirac found a letter from Wheeler on his doormat. And I just want to read these wonderfully generous words to someone who feels like that, right? This is what Wheeler wrote. I write to tell you what I'm not sure you divine, how many of the younger generation as well as the older one look up to you as a hero, as a model of how to do things right, of passion for rectitude as well as for beauty. He died 3 years after that picture was taken. He never lost his mind, the thing he most dreaded. His last paper was still in preparation, and that was another execration of quantum field theory. He, as you will all know better than me, I'm sure, that Dirac remains posthumously productive. Still, if you go onto archive, you look at these newspapers, you still see Dirac's approach, his mathematics, his physics, inspiring people like yourself. But as I was finishing the book, I came across the most extraordinary example of this from my friend Juan Maldacena, whose wonderful papers on ADS-CFT, Juan wrote those papers, was it 1997? You'll know better than I do. And after he sent off that first paper, some colleagues came up to him, this was a few weeks afterwards, and said, have you seen some of your mathematics looks remarkably similar? And they pointed to two papers he hadn't read. And he saw that the mathematical seeds of crucial parts of that paper were in papers written by Paul Dirac, two of them, one in 1936, one in 1963, which is when Dirac was 61 years old. And one, who is, I'm sure you know them, the nicest guy in the world, said, "You're perfectly at liberty to say, you know, that that this was foundational work in ADF-CFT. Crucial point, ladies and gentlemen, what I'd like to stress is that at the time, that was seen as completely irrelevant stuff. I could find no references to those papers beyond respectful references to what Dirac was doing. It's often said that Dirac was completely unchanged. He never changed from when he was a teenager to when he was an old man. Signature was the same, his personality was the same. But, you know, in one crucial way, that at least that was not true. And that's in the field of aesthetics. Because in 1925, as I mentioned, this man was vehemently anti-religion, vehemently anti-philosophy. By the time he got to this age, he was a religious philosopher in favor of the beauty of mathematical physics. Thank you very much. Yeah, sure.
Let
me not detect. I will send them to you. Juan has provided me with. I'll put them on my Twitter page. But I will send to. If you want, I can make sure you get them. But they are basically papers about the Lorentz group and irreducible representations thereof. Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful talk. Thank you. Wonderful book. I don't understand why you're perplexed about Dirac's conviction that quantum electrodynamics wasn't mathematically sound, because we're pretty confident now that it's not mathematically sound.
Mm-hmm.
After many years, there is no rigorous construction of quantum electrodynamics,
mm-hmm.
and there's a belief that it's not a perturbation. The perturbation theory is not a perturbation theory around quantum field theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he was right.
Well, I have to say, I'm not prepared to hold arguments about physics with learned people in this room. I asked Witten about that, so that gives me a fairly big gun to hold again, right? No, seriously, I'm not trying to trouble you, because I'm just giving you what I was taught on this, right? Because I don't know the ins and outs of I believe the conventional view is that renormalization group theory tidies up quantum electrodynamics. You don't regard that as true?
Renormalization group theory suggests that it's a trivial theory, not
all right.
Clearly,
okay.
There may be some theory that it's an expansion around. We hope that it is, but it's not quantum
okay.
electrodynamics.
Okay. As I said, quoting Witten as best I can, he says he said in his office he could just about see some ways in which Dirac might possibly be right. So you maybe know things that Witten does, but I.
this is not radical. So there's consensus that theories which are not as radically free.
Uh-huh.
Only have trivial fixed points of
the normal. Yeah. Okay. Well, Edward did say to me that it was definitely rigorously true that QCD was the asymptotic theory of the strong interaction. That is free of those infinities, yes?
Well, there's no theorem.
Okay.
It's still
well, you must teach me more afterwards. I defer to your greater knowledge. But
the evidence is that QCD is not. No,
okay. Okay. Well, I look forward to being educated seriously about on that. So I have learned. You can learn more from you on that. Yeah.
Questions?
Oh dear. If you want to ask them privately afterwards, I'd be delighted to talk afterwards.
Well, if there aren't so
yeah.
On the grave, there was somebody Jordan behind you. Where is the grave?
Excuse me.
You showed a picture of his grave on the cemetery.
It's hard to find.
Where is it?
It's in Roselaw Cemetery in Tallahassee.
So the person, the Jordan behind is not a physicist.
Excuse me?
There's a name Jordan on the picture.
No, everyone says that. Yeah, that's not, it's not Pascal Jordan.
Okay.
One little thing, incidentally, let me go, this. There it is.
Yeah.
And incidentally, that his wife was very, very keen that he was appropriated into religion, Orthodox religion. So she had put on the grave there because God made it that way. See? Here? Now, what Dirac meant, of course, was he was believed in Einstein, Spinoza-type God, right? right? But she, even at his funeral, had the oldest book of prayer read over his grave, even though he was a vehement non-believer in the conventional sense. But he did believe in the Spinozan, Einsteinian, harmony of the universe type God, and that's how that phrase came on there. This is her dog, incidentally. Not her real dog, but a stone dog here. That is not Pastoral Yorkin, no. Yeah?
What drew you to the subject? What drew you to Dirac and
Frank? To be honest, it was fascination. I heard about him on a doorstep from a mad theoretical physicist when I was a 17-year-old. No, I'm perfectly serious. And he was upset. His daughter was called Paula, for good reason, And at this time of the year, he reads the Principles of Quantum Mechanics, reads it every single Christmas. So I happened to be attracted to this character, but I knew nothing about him as a character. But that's how it started. That's how it corrupted my youth. One more?
Is there anywhere to access Dirac's old papers online, or do you know of any sources for his old papers?
Well, on my Twitter thing, I will put some of them are online. The relation between mathematics and physics, which is a classic paper in my view, absolute classic paper, that is available online. Publicly available, I don't know. I've just bought the Daleks book and I use JSTOR like I guess you do. But they all read in a very modern way. And as I said, there's better things to do in one's spare time than read football books or something. There are Dirac papers really do repay. As one Malbusena found, I'll say he went back and said, if only I'd read this thing earlier.
Okay, so before we thank Graham, let me just remind you that there should be snacks downstairs, and you can ask Graham more questions then. So let's thank Graham.
Great audience, thanks very much.